going to whisper some things to you now about Crunch chocolate bars, because apparently this whispering thing is a thing that makes you feel things. It's saying something crunchy is coming in the candy wrapper language. Imagine your tongue hiking up those crispy, rocky ridges. Now, drumroll, please.
Wow, that's good. Crunchy, munchy chocolate doesn't whisper.
Turn up the fun with Crunch.
Manchester's indie rock and roll station, XS Manchester.
The XS Manchester Long Player, an iconic album in full with Jim Salveson.
XS Manchester.
Hello, musical loving friends. I'm Jim Salveson, and this is the XS Long Player, looking back and deep into classic indie albums. Today's classic album, well, it's only a couple of years old, but I still think it falls into that category because it was the first album from a Scottish band as a debut release to get to number one in the UK charts since The View's Hats Off to the Buskers, a album that has previously featured on the XS Long Play. You can go back and listen to the interview with Carl Faulkner. But we're not talking about that now. We're talking about the Snuts debut album, WL, from 2021. And what an album this is. Genuinely, I think it's one of the best albums of the last 10 years, and I get to talk about it in all its glory with Callum from the band. If you listen to the radio show version of this podcast, where we play through the whole album and talk about each track by track, then there's a load more in this podcast that you won't have heard in the radio show, because A, some of the stories just weren't fit for radio, B, Callum likes a bit of fruity language, and that doesn't go down very well on radio stations, and C, there's a bit of chat in here about what the band are up to now and why they split from the record label and the new album that's coming out very soon. It is a treat for Snuts fans, this, so I hope you enjoy it. Callum from the Snuts talking about WL. Callum, how you doing, man?
I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, really good, thanks. So we're looking at your debut album today, WL, which feels like it was absolutely ages ago, but actually only came out in 2021. I think it feels so long ago because there's been a lot of water under the bridge since then. There's been a lot of music since then as well.
Yeah.
But actually, rather than 2021, to get kind of the full story of this album, I think we need to go back a little bit further, back to the very start of the band and the origin of the Snuts, which I believe, now correct me if I'm wrong, I believe the Snuts started as an entity because ultimately you were looking for a way to get into pubs when you're underage and have a beer.
Do you know, I think that's how like probably 80% of young bands in Britain actually start out, because you never think it's actually possible to do it as a job, so you're only trying to use it as leverage to get free drinks and stuff. But that certainly was the case with us. So there's a pub in Bathgate. So we were from Whitburn, but there's a town next door which is like slightly bigger, and that had a pub called The Attic, and that's where bands played. And then there was a pub underneath called The Lounge, but if you got in The Attic, it meant you could just get in The Lounge, like, just, you know, on a Wednesday and stuff. So like, that was the kind of, that was us made it at that point. We kind of just wanted to do pub circuit, but luckily it's turned out slightly better than just doing the pub circuit.
Was there a moment when it kind of flipped for you and you suddenly went from going, hang on, this is a way we can get a pint, to there's something in this, there's a career here, or if not a career, there's like more than a hobby?
I think it was like, I would probably say it's when we recorded Glasgow, would be like the demo version of Glasgow, would be the kind of moment where like, oh, like shit, people seem to be catching on. We played it in a, so we just recorded Glasgow, say that weekend we had a charity gig, or it had maybe been out 2 weeks or something. And then we had a charity gig in like a local pub again. But we only had six songs, but we were headlining. So like, we played to the six songs, and then folk were like, one more tune in that. And we're like, we don't have any more tunes. We started with Glasgow, and then we played it again at the end. And people like lost their shit, and they were like, maybe there's something in this. Do you know that way? There was only about 30 people in the pub, but it kind of made us think like, shit, if we can get this reaction here, like what would happen if we kind of branched out a bit? So then we just kept knocking out demos. It was our mate, Jamie Lafferty, he was paying for them at the time. He had his shit slightly more together than we did. So he was paying for the demos, and his mate, who's turned out to our mate, James Grant, he was recording them in his bedroom. So once we kind of done those demos, we were kind of away with the head down, and we sold out a local cricket club, which was like just run by like a kind of like local gangster character who let us like sell it to as many people as could come in. Like, do you know, it was like a complete fire hazard. Mate, honestly, I'm not joking. So you see, at the time it felt like it was about 1,000 people there. I bet it was about maybe 150. But after that gig, we were like, shit, we should maybe try and turn this into something.
So the two bands that I think in those early days that I heard you being compared to time and time again were the Libertines and the Arctic Monkeys. They were kind of the two comparisons that were often made, a Scottish Libertines or a Glasgow Arctic Monkeys or something like that. But the other phrase that I've heard banded around connected with you, and you're going to have to educate a stupid Englishman here, was Scottish Ned culture. Now, I've got no idea what Scottish Ned culture is. Can you enlighten me in any way?
I would say like the English equivalent would be like a chav.
Oh, right,
so okay. Like, do you know what I mean? Like we used to rip about and like bear boots jackets zipped right up, like trackies, socks tucked into the trackies, Air Maxes, like Reebok classics, like that kind of. Right. It's actually turned into quite an aesthetic. Like, do you know, it's quite a hipster aesthetic now, but back then it was just like you were hanging about in the streets and you had to stay warm. So you were wearing like mountaineering clothes. The only way I could describe it is like somebody from Liverpool. Do you know what I mean? Like that kind of vibe, man. That was like the vibe. That was what we were all about, man. I don't know if that's it. We have such affinity, like as Scottish people, we have such an affinity with Scousers because our cultures are very, very similar. So it's like kind of like that vibe, man. So we were playing in forests and stuff. So we were like rapping about, like dressed like that, but also with acoustic guitars. So it was like a bit of a juxtaposition. So we would kind of play for like people would like, obviously like some people would be drinking, some people might be smoking and that, just then we would be playing our guitars in the corner, almost like a soundtrack to the antisocial behaviour. Like that kind of, so it was like, you know, like wholesome, it was wholesome, but also antisocial. It was a juxtaposition.
If we're talking about influences, I think the one quote that really stood out for me when I was looking back at the early days and the interviews you did back at the start was, you said, our biggest inspiration is not to sound exactly like anybody else. How much of a mission statement did that become for the band when you're pulling that album together? Were there tunes that kind of you had knocking about that you might have recorded demos of or you might have been throwing around as a band that just didn't make the cut purely because you went, ah, that sounds too much like that band or that sounds too much like that band?
Maybe not as much that, but we went through a period just before we started properly recording the first album where every song that we wrote just sounded like us again, but like repurposed, like in repackaged. And we kind of went through a bit of a rut with that just before we actually started recording because, like, so we went to LA to record the first album and in our heads, the album was done. Like, we had 12 songs there. They were written. They just needed re-recorded to a better level. But they were super similar to each other almost. And then we went over to LA and the producer we were up to at the time, Inflow, basically, like, wrapped all the songs up we had and, like, made us start again. And at the time, I think that felt like a really, like almost like a personal attack. Like I don't think we really understood like what he was trying to do with that. But in a way that kind of forced us to create the album we did because like the tracks just wouldn't exist in it if we hadn't had that kind of moment of realisation. And also there would be probably tracks on it that we are glad now aren't on it because they're just not as strong and they didn't represent us as well. So there's certainly been stuff we've cut before that's maybe sounded too much like us in a past incarnation as opposed to anybody else. So I think that would be more of a mission statement. We try not to sound like ourselves too much.
So where would that drive to be different kind of come from in that case? If you've got this set of albums that you're taking to a producer and he's sitting down and he's going, no, we need to rip these up, we need to make these sound different. Was that intention from those sessions or was the producer kind of picking up on those intentions and going, look, this is what I know you want, even if you don't know you want it almost?
Mate, see, to be honest, right, I actually don't know because, like, I don't know if, like, Inflow, man, he's quite like a, what's like, a, almost like a mystical character. So, like, he speaks entirely in riddles. Everything's a lesson. He would, like, take you to the cinemas halfway through the recording session as you were putting down a take and then just leave you there for, like, 4 hours. He would phone you at, like, 10 o'clock at night and just tell you you had to come in straight away and then you'd be in till 7 in the morning. So, like, I don't know the method to his madness, but it seemed to work.
Was there a stretch? I mean, you mentioned the guys earlier that kind of produced the demos. Was there ever a difficulty in kind of moving on from them and taking on a new producer for the production of the album and leaving your mates that had kind of helped you in the early days behind?
I definitely think that is quite a big part in why we didn't re-record a lot of songs that we maybe had sitting on EPs and stuff. Not that not in the sense that anyone would be offended or something, but like just at that point in time, that song was complete and it was fine the way it was. Do you know what I mean? It was perfect the way it was. You didn't need to change it. But then you come into a room with another producer and a lot of stuff changes. So you leave this disconnect with fans who were maybe super attached to a demo version of a track. Then they hear the reproduced version and it doesn't quite take them to the heights and doesn't make them feel the same emotionally as that first version. So you're almost competing against yourself. So I would say we felt more like that as opposed to guilty or something for moving away, because, you know, everybody understands that as you start to progress, and anybody that works in the music industry starts to understand that, like, as you progress, it's not about, like, having, like, friends and, like, you doing somebody over or something, moving to a more professional setup. It's just, like, there's levels to everything. Do you know what I mean? Like, there was a point we were happy once we played all the venues and that we wanted to play in the pub circuit in Scotland. We felt like we were on top. And then you break to the next level and then the next level, and it's like kind of a constant tiered cake that you never ever get to the icing in the top. So I don't think anybody ever felt offended or anything. I just think we didn't feel we could give the songs justice again. So we just stuck to, we re-recorded Sing For Your Supper and we re-recorded Glasgow, which were fan favourites, and then we just kept everything else as it was.
I want to come back to the re-recording of Glasgow in a little bit, but before I do, in terms of the tracks on this album, fair few of them were written in those early days of the band. You mentioned Glasgow earlier and that kind of being the song that made you go, oh, hang on, there's something in this. So we're talking about songs that were recorded, maybe some of them when you were as young as 15. It's best part of a decade, maybe, between that and the album being released.
Yeah.
How did you as a band, how did your relationship change with those songs? Because if I look back when I was 25 at something I'd written when I was 15, I don't think I'd recognise the person that was writing that.
Mm-hmm.
Is it the same when you've kind of got a song that's kind of been with you that long?
I would say with some songs, like songs that we don't play anymore, like they make sense to not play anymore. Like you always have like a fan, like, so we released a song like Manhattan Project before we released the first record. Like, oh, play Manhattan Project. And it was like, that was a bit like one of us breaking up with like our 17-year-old girlfriend when we were 17 or something. Like, do you know what I mean? Or like, so it's like, why would we play that? But then there's like ones like, do you like Sing For Your Supper? We don't really play that anymore, but like we still recorded it for the album. That was about like our mate who had left to move to Australia, and he's moved back. He stays here now. Do you know what I mean? So it's like there's some songs that you definitely like, the emotional part of it is long gone, is like dead and buried. Even Glasgow, like the emotional part of that for us is probably gone as to its original meaning. But now what it means is like that moment of like looking at, and when the riff kicks in, you see the crowd go and like you see people chanting it. And suddenly a song like that takes on a new meaning because it's now like it belongs to the fans at that point. By the time the song's written, recorded, as an artist, you've kind of had your catharticness. I don't even know if that's a word, but like you've had your fun with it, if you know what I mean. You've released what you need to release and you've recorded this bit of music. And then when a song lasts 10 years, that stops belonging to you. Like that is no longer your song at that point. That is just something that means a lot to people. It's a memory at that point. It's a moment. It's something they can fucking play at their wedding if they want. That at that point, I think I'm getting all emotional. I don't even know what I'm talking about. I've had two coffees this morning. I'm just running, mate.
I know what you mean. And it's something a lot of artists on this podcast have talked about before, the idea that when you release a song, at that moment in time, it's no longer your record. It's someone else's record. It's someone else's tune. It's an audience's. They put their own meaning on it. And it almost becomes like folk music. It's like it gets taken to different places that you probably don't intend in the first place.
Yeah, 100%. But that's like, you know, folk music's some of the oldest music in the world. So if in 2,000 years somebody could be humming the top line melody to Glasgow, I would love that. I would love that. That would be amazing.
Looking back at this album, and I was listening back to it earlier, it's really varied. And I think obviously you kind of outlined the reasons why the producer came in and you wanted to make it varied. And that was the intention of the band from the get-go, that you didn't want to sound the same. You didn't want to sound like yourself on each tune. But was there ever a concern about how it would hang together as kind of one record, as one piece of work, when you've got all these different influences and all these different sounds going on?
1,000%. Like, do you know how many record label meetings we've been in or like, there is no cohesion in this music. This doesn't fucking sound like an album. This doesn't even, these two tracks, you can't even release a double A side because they sound that different. Do you know what I mean? Like, we've kind of had that all our lives. We've always had somebody telling us that the way that we're doing it isn't quite the way we should be doing it. And we should always try and, did anybody fucking tell Picasso? See, when he drew a nose on somebody's forehead, was anybody like, Picasso, that nose shouldn't be on that forehead? Because he knows it's not meant to be on that forehead, but he's created it. Do you know what I mean? It's about expressing yourself. So with that first record, man, it is a bit of a mixed bag. And there is definitely, like, I can understand a record label's confusion at it. But to us, it made sense. And hopefully the fans, it made sense. So I wouldn't change anything about it.
Leading up to the release of the record, there was this buzz that was kind of building up around you, and there was loads of significant things that were happening along the way. There was like Radio 1 playlist, which was amazing. Annie Mac kind of playing your tunes for the very first time. You got featured on FIFA 21 on the soundtrack to that, which is like, that's a dream for most people. Was there a particular moment before the album came out that you just kind of sat back and went, this is madness. There's something happening here. How did we get to this point?
So before we just released the EP leading into the record, and we'd done a lot of the recording for the record, and then Strongbow asked us to do a cover somewhere in the city, and they flew us to South Africa for like 4 days, business class, like an absolutely, like we used to stay in travel lodges, like up religiously up and down the country, any service station travel lodge, I've probably stayed at it. So to jump through those like both sharing a room in travel lodges to get took business class to like a 6-star hotel in South Africa, with like your own jacuzzi in the room and that. And like we went in and they had like 3 outfits for us hanging up and stuff that was all the right sizes and stuff. And that was a bit like, yeah, this is definitely slightly better than playing the pub circuit. But yeah, it was really cool, man. It was nice. I liked it. I like being shoulder to shoulder. There's something that makes you feel nice about it. Do you know what I mean? When I see when I've got Jordan that side and Joe that side and I'm just kind of asleep for 16 hours. That's kind of my happy place. So business class was almost wasted on me.
We spoke earlier about the period of time between the formation of the band and the recording and the release of the album, which was quite a long time, which was made even longer by the arrival of COVID, which delayed the release. At the time, you'd been sitting on the record. I think it had been pretty much completed for 3 years already. And then kind of COVID hit and you had to wait that little bit more. What was that like, just kind of going, I mean, it's probably the right decision at the end of the day, but like hitting pause and going, we don't know when we're going to be able to give this record to the fans.
Yeah, it was quite mad, COVID, man, because we actually, it feels like we recorded 2 records in COVID, but it was actually a wee bit of a blessing because as much as we said the record was finished, we kept recording. So like, even though like we felt the record, it was like almost a ruthless edit because it meant that if you recorded something that was better, something else just came off. And then it just went like that. So like there was tracks like Somebody Loves You. We hadn't even recorded that until lockdown. And then in the that kind of lull period where you could travel if you had like a letter for like your mum basically saying you're allowed to travel. So we got to go down to London and we actually done a lot of recording in that time and a lot of tweaking throughout that period, which was quite nice because it just gave us time to really get it in a place that we were totally happy with.
I want to talk about a couple of specific tracks off the album, if that's all right. And I'd like you to pick a couple too in a moment. So maybe tracks that you just love or there's stuff that linked to it or memories or moments from the recording or whatever really, it's up to you. But first, I want to talk about, we've already mentioned it, Glasgow, which was the first track that made me aware of you. And I think it's probably the same for quite a lot of people. It was the first track that kind of gave you that mass awareness. And it was a fan favourite. There was a lot of love for the original version and the demo version. So when you went in to record it for the album, were there trepidations about re-recording it and potentially, like you say, disconnecting with the people who liked it originally?
It's trepidations, by the way. I was trying to find that word earlier to use and you've just used it amazingly there. Man, I'm not going to lie, right? So we were, I think everybody was a wee bit shitting themselves from recording Glasgow. So we recorded it. So it was like all this build-up. So we basically recorded most of the record and we were back down in the Warner building in London. And where is it? I can't remember, but it's in London. And underneath it, they've got a studio called The Fire Pit. And it's like basically like recording music, but like next door to his Darth Vader kind of vibes. Do you know what I mean? Like it's like this pure evil lair. And the bottom is just this like really fucking nice studio. The guy that runs it, Rich Woodcraft, he's like one of the nicest, most legendary guys in the world. And the amount of stuff he's mixed and touched, like the amount of great records he's touched is like, Google Rich Woodcraft discography and just look at his mixing thing. It's fucking insane, right? So he runs our studio. So we were in with Tony Hoffer and him. Tony was like, he's American. He's like, guys, how are we going to crack this? How are we going to crack this track? And we're like thinking, like, oh, what we got to do? Like, do you know, we played this live. It was all, we were always drunk. It was scrappy and stuff. So he's like, I know what we need to do. And he had this rule that was like no hard liquor in the studio. And so he comes back into the studio and he's got 4 bottles of Buckfast sitting, one for each of us, in our instrument set up, like as if we were going to play live. He's like, right, So he, and Jordan, sorry, was through in another room. He had his bottle of wine in another room. And the three of us, me, Joe, and Jack, set up in one room. And he was like, the only way we can capture this energy is if you just keep drinking as you're recording. So we just fucking smashed it, honestly, mate. We just smashed it take after take. And he'd be like, guys, drink. And we'd drink more. And he'd be like, right, go again. And we'd go again, right? And he just fucking done that for ages, man. And so I think this was maybe like that a night. And then the next again morning, we came in overdubs and stuff, jacked in a vocal. And it's like, it actually really slotted together really nicely. It felt like there was a lot of fear kind of for nothing. And then once you started like drinking that liquid confidence, it kind of started dissolving. And I think Tony really got, well, between Tony and Jack in the mix, they really got the energy and like what Glasgow was. And I think they really done it justice, bringing it into this era of the Snuts. Well, that era of the Snuts, but in a fucking different era of the Snuts now, but do you know what I mean?
So ultimately, is the version that's on the album is at least in part recorded as live, powered by Buckfast?
Yeah, that's it, mate. Powered by Buckfast. That's it. Yeah. Honestly, it's so funny. But do you know, we reached out to Buckfast like during like, I don't really drink it anymore, but like during our kind of, as this first record was kicking off, like, come on, like, get behind the boys and that bit of support. And they do not appreciate it at all. Like, they're like, no, we are religious monks who make this fucking drink for old people. It's like, no, you don't. You're not, you know who you make it for. You're a fucking hypocrite. God won't save you.
Okay. Right, the second track I want to talk about is Juan Belmonte, which is a song that's named after a Spanish bullfighter. Now, for a band and an album that I think is, in general, I think it's quite rooted in your surroundings. It, like Glasgow, Boardwalk, Somebody Loves You. It's all kind of got connections to Glasgow and West Lothian and kind of Scotland. It felt like a bit of a leap to me when I saw that song. And is it, does it come from the same place as kind of the inspiration point of view, the idea that you want to do something different? Was that kind of the point behind it, or is it a little bit deeper than that?
I mean, it's actually less deep than that. Okay. So like, so seeing Scotland, right? See if like, if you say one, if you're like just like speaking colloquially, you say one, like I would have one of them. Like, so we used to call that track, because it's just a big riff and a big beat, we used to call it the big one all the time, right? So it was like, it was, oh, do you want to play the big one in that? Like, we didn't have a name for it, right? So we'd play it, we'd play it, play it. And we just released the Matador EP. So then we're like, it'd be funny to name this, like, one, like the Spanish name. And then he googled like who was the most, the biggest Spanish matador, and it came up Juan Belmonte is the most celebrated Spanish matador. And we were like, and it was like just a big fat swaggery tune, and we're like, Juan Belmonte. And from that point, it never references Juan Belmonte once in the song, like not once. His niece reached out to us and remembers like, that's my uncle, cheers for using them on a track.
Nice. Wow. Okay, cool. Right, I want you to pick a couple of tracks off it then. So anything that you love off the album, or there's a moment that you remember from being in the studio or the writing, what would be your picks off the tracks on WL?
So I'm going to say, like, All Your Friends is, like, quite a big one for me, just because, so we arrived in LA and we were working with Inflow, and he kind of sat, took us out in this room, and we were in this studio, and it's called Downtown LA, and it's basically like a, you ever seen Ghostbusters?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, see, like, the big house they've got in Ghostbusters, that they're kind of their base of operations.
Yeah, the fire station.
Yeah, like, that's, like, the vibe of DTLA, right? It's, like, totally, like, you can exposed brickwork and, like, sliding doors, and, like, you can hear crickets. Like, there's crickets live in the studio, and you can hear them as you're walking about. So, like, we'd never seen anything like this. We used to record in an industrial estate in Livingston, so it was, like, this was, like, a fucking different world. We walks up to the studio, and it's, like, us four and our managers came, and Inflow's inside. So he brings us into this room, five of us sit on a couch, and he just gets us to play through influences and stuff. We're playing that, and he's just like, to our manager, right, you fuck off, basically. And our manager's like, what? And he's like, go. We're like, oh, like, you don't need to be here, and that, like, you're fucking, you're ruining everything, kind of vibes. And our manager was like, what? And then left, he go fucked it, basically, so he left. And then he was like, right, so he set us all up in different corners of this room, but we were all in the one room, and he was like, go and play something. And we're like, shit, so we're all playing different stuff and that, like, can't really hear each other, kind of vibes. And, like, he was speaking to Jack, like, maybe, like, 20 feet away from me. And I didn't even have my guitar plugged in. I just played that, like, boom, 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 boom. And, like, I've actually got the recording on my phone because I was recording it. And you just hear him, like, stopping his conversation. He's like, Hugh, that was cold. Come here. Like, he just took me. He recorded that riff. Like, honestly, he recorded that riff in, like, 10 seconds. And he was like, right, basically, like, I'm done with you. Go. Wow. And I was done. And he got some drums off Jordan. And then we all got kicked out of the studio too. Me, Joe, and Jordan got kicked out of the studio. And then we came in the next day And it was like first verse and chorus to All Your Friends and started. So it was like, for me, it was really the thing that kind of kicked us off. But I always remember him just like, it was like, you could barely hear it. But it was like his ear is obviously that good. Like when he recognises something that he loves, he can just find it. So that was a big one for me. They're all kind of got emotional attachments. Before we kind of came on this, I wrote out like every song. And then like a kind of story about every song, but like obviously I can't do that. I would talk for them like fucking 3 days. And it's like, it was really nice. Do you know, it was really nice actually. Like, I don't listen to the record. It's not like you sit and listen to your own record, do you know what I mean? Well, maybe people do, but I don't. So it was like nice just to like delve back into these tracks. So like I was kind of delving back into it, just listening and just thinking about like the stories and stuff. And it's like every single track, there was like, I'm quite lucky to have this because it like documents so many points in your life. Like people just go through their lives and they don't have like these fragments of memories stored in places like Spotify or like your mate's hard drive and stuff. So it's nice to kind of go back in. Another one for me that I thought was like super nice was like when No Place I'd Rather Go. And it was about a mate, Blair Murray, man. And we were like in LA and we were all best mates at the time. And we're still really good mates. But like we went to LA and we're like missing our friends and we felt like we should be in this like dream world. And No Place was born. And there's just loads of lyrics in it. There's like a lyric and it's like Wine by the Rocks. And it's just like talking about us being like 15, 16 year olds. We used to like drink at this set of rocks called like the Westy Rocks, they were called. And it's like now Blair's got that, like he played at his dad's funeral and stuff. And it's just, you know, one of these songs that like before a song like even becomes your fans and stuff, like you're just playing this to your mates. So it kind of belongs to your mates as well. So see when your mate, like a song means so much to your mate and then like you see all these important points of their life and they always lead to that song. I think stuff like that's quite beautiful. It's not really a funny story about that song. That was a bit heavy. But aye, man, No Place, man. I love playing that live as well. And I always think, man, especially like I just remember we played a gig and it was like 2 weeks after his dad died, man. And like, you know, playing that song was like, it was just proper, like, super emotional, man.
And as you said earlier, I'm sure there's people who love the band or have attached those kind of stories to those tunes as well.
Man, therefore.
I could sit and talk to you through all the tracks, but I'm probably conscious of time, so I want to talk instead about when the album came out, the album actually finally dropping, because came out, went to number one in the album charts, first Scottish band since The View to get a debut number one record, which was helped in some parts by Lewis Capaldi lending his support and encouraging his kind of army of followers to get behind the record and kind of download it and buy it and listen to it and all that kind of thing. How did that come about? How did that relationship with Lewis Capaldi come about? Is it just because you're from the same area of Scotland?
So we've knew Lewis. We've knew Lewis for ages, man. So like, even like back to like when Tea in the Park was kind of happening, I remember like Lewis, like, so like everybody used to sit in like a big circle with their chairs. And like Lewis was like, we were all mad Ben Howard fans and we're going to see Ben Howard. But I think he was going at the same time as like 1975 or something. And Lewis was just like, 1975 are fucking amazing. And we're like, oh, Ben Howard's fucking amazing. Like it was like that kind of like drunken argument. But I was known each other for a while. So I went to Whitburn Academy. He went to St. Kent's, but Jack got kicked out of Whitburn and had to go to St. Kent's. So they kind of knew each other through school. And then we obviously, like, the pub circuit in West Lothian wasn't exactly massive. So, like, do you know, I actually seen Lewis, it was before he got signed. He used to be in a band called Cool Blue. And I seen them in the attic that I was talking about earlier. They played Adam Warrington, you know, Youngblood's guitarist. Yeah. So he was Lewis's guitarist at the time. Like, I know Adam as well. We were all kind of like kicking about at the same time. Like, I just remember being blown away in that, like, room, just like, man, he's fucking amazing. He's seriously, like, that voice is incredible. And then, like, fast forward, like, he got signed, we got signed and stuff. So, yeah, we've known Lewis for a while. We actually played a gig with him in Wagoner from the X Factor at one point as well. So we've kind of came through the same shit gig struggle as each other, but he is obviously stratospherically bigger than us now.
Only for now. Callum, really nice to speak to you about WL. I genuinely think it's not just one of the best debut albums of the last 5 years. I think it's one of the best albums of the last 5 years.
Cheers, man.
I just want to pick up briefly. This isn't about WL, but I just want to ask you, because it reminded me when you were speaking earlier about kind of the struggles with record label conversations and kind of them not quite getting where you're going. Obviously, recently you've split up with your label. You've gone and done your own thing, which huge admiration for you guys to go and set up on your own and kind of do what you want to do, basically. Is that why you've kind of made that call to give you the freedom to do what you want to do?
Yeah, just across the board. So definitely maybe not as much the first record because we were kind of learning the ropes as well. But the second record, especially towards like the selling of it and the marketing it, we kind of noticed ourselves and the label just kind of like diverging on nearly every single point that came up. We would kind of have opposite opinions and like, well, we almost had opposite intentions and mad. Like, I think we actually had an opposite end goal and everything. So I think it was like always destined for this to happen. And I think the guy who signed us, Nick Burgess, is a massive guitar head. Like, he signed Blossoms, he done The Kooks, he's done like a lot of guitar stuff and he loves that. But I think he was trying to drag us into a world that we maybe, no, drag us. I love Nick, he was a great guy. But I think he wanted a bigger thing for us than what we were. I think to be in that system, you need to be willing to compromise everything. Like, I think you need to, you have to be prepared to do that. And I don't think we were prepared to do that. I think as well, creatively, like, not even necessarily musically, but everything in, like, do you know the way you dress and stuff? And, like, but at one point they banned us from wearing the jackets zipped up and stuff. Like, do you know what I mean? Like it was just, like, flat. Like, it was just total different goals, different opinions on everything. So we decided we had to kind of take things back into our own hands, or we would just become a band that we never intended to be. We had a really damning last meeting with them, where they kind of told us that the music didn't matter, and we had to basically go home and study the charts and find out what TikTok hits were like working and stuff. And I was like, shit, man, I didn't leave the school to fucking come and do homework. And it was a great time. Like, we had a great time at Warner and Parlophone. We made some great music, made some great friends, but it just reached the point where we were like, we've got to stop enjoying doing this if we keep doing this way. So why not take things into our own hands and just see what happens? You know what I mean? Roll the dice, back our own horse. And since we've done it, we have made more money from streams in this 6 months than we made in 4 years of Parlophone. So that kind of exposes the major label system for what it is. There's more money in music now than there's ever been, but it is distributed unfairly to the artist. So we had to leave.
Fair play.
So what's next? We've got some new music from you, but we don't have any information yet on an album or when it's coming out or what it's going to look like, or even if the singles we've had are going to be from an album. Can you tell us anything yet about when we're going to be able to get our hands on it? If it exists.
Oh, it exists in its entirety. It is completed. So we're just having a wee bit of downtime now, just chilling, just taking a bit of time to like regroup. We toured quite hard towards the end of last year, so we needed a bit of time to recenter. But there is a single coming out super soon, and there's got to be more, lots more.
Nice one, man. Really nice to talk to you, talk us through the debut. Really enjoyed it. I'll tell you what, you should sit down and listen to it at some point, because it's cracking. You might really enjoy it.
Right through. I will. I'll try and get all the way through it. There's about fucking 30 songs in it, mate. I've not got that kind of time.
Nice one, mate.
Right, see you later, man.
The Excess Manchester Long Player, an iconic album in full with Jim Salverson.
Excess Manchester.
Told you it was a good one. Awesome chat with Callum. Awesome album as well. If you've not listened to WL in a bit, go back through it. Get stuck in. The link is in the podcast description, as is the link to The View, Hats Off to the Buskers, which, as I said, was the previous debut album from a Scottish band to get to number one in the album charts before the Snuts stole that title. Loads more episodes to get stuck into if you enjoyed this one. Loads of awesome albums from awesome bands and memories, stories and inspirations from the people who helped make that album. Have a look in the back catalogue, see what takes your fancy. And don't forget to like and subscribe to this podcast so you get the next episode as soon as it's ready. And if you want to get in touch and tell me who you'd like to hear from in this series, you can do it via the Q&A function on Spotify. You can get me on Twitter at Mr_JimBob, or just leave a rating or review with your thoughts. See you soon.
The Excess Manchester Long Player, an iconic album in full with Jim Salverson.
Excess Manchester.